This is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick in Washington, in for Joshua Johnson.
In a few moments, I'll be signing an executive order imposing hard-hitting sanctions on the Supreme Leader of Iran and the Office of the Supreme Leader of Iran and many others. Today's action follows a series of aggressive behaviors by the Iranian regime in recent weeks, including shooting down of U.S. drones. You shot down the drone. I guess everyone saw that one and many other things.
That was President Trump announcing new sanctions from the Oval Office on Monday. It's the latest move by the Trump administration after weeks of escalating tensions between the United States and Iran. An Iranian spokesperson has said that the new sanctions mean the end of diplomacy between the U.S. and Iran for good. Now, that kind of saber-rattling rhetoric is a reliable feature of tensions between the United States and Iran. But just today, state media reported that Iran, as promised, has surpassed a key limitation on how much nuclear fuel it can have under the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. So where does the Trump administration's foreign policy strategy lead? Are we on the brink of war? We'll put those questions to someone who has an intimate knowledge of Iran and a lot to say about President Trump's foreign policy agenda. Jason Rezaian, he's global opinions writer at The Washington Post and author of Prisoner, My 544 Days in an Iranian Prison. He joins me now here in Washington, D.C. Jason, welcome to 1A.
Thanks, Todd. How are you?
I'm very well. It's great to have you. And I'm also well because later in the hour, we're going to speak with Star Trek actor and activist George Takei about his story of imprisonment, the time he spent as a child in a Japanese-American internment camp during World War II. It's the subject of his new graphic memoir called They Called Us Enemy, something, Jason, unfortunately, that you and George Takei have somewhat in common, and we'll get to him later in the hour. I want to spend some time with you on Iran, however. Briefly remind us, Jason, while we have you here, of the terms of the 2015 JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal, and sort of how we got to this point of new sanctions against the authoritarian regime, the theocrats in Iran, and Iran's response or predicate that they will exceed the threshold on their nuclear fuel.
Well, Todd, essentially the nuclear deal, which was struck in 2015, was an agreement made between Iran and the world powers, the permanent members of the Security Council, plus Germany, that would limit the range of activities of that nuclear program to be limited to non-weaponization with very low caps on enrichment for essentially medical and energy purposes. There was a strict inspections regimes put in place that would make it impossible for Iran to weaponize their program unless there was a kicking out of those inspectors in exchange for lifting of sanctions against Iran for its nuclear activities. This was something that the Iranian regime had decided they would do because the sanctions, frankly, under the Obama administration were so tough, and the public was growing very restless under the economic weight of those sanctions. So, you know, it was a deal that by all accounts was not perfect, but it did stop Iran from ever having the possibility of weaponizing. And by the way, all of our intelligence and all the international intelligence at the time and now says that Iran hadn't been actively trying to weaponize their nuclear program since the early 2000s.
Well, it can be hard to know exactly where we stand with Iran. It's a bit bewildering, and maybe that's by design. The United States makes an agreement under what you just described, the JCPOA. Mm-hmm. President Trump pulls us out of that agreement, followed by new sanctions, maximum pressure, escalation in the Gulf and in the Straits of Hormuz, shooting down of drones. Drones and the like, and all the while the president using rhetoric like he's open to meeting with Iran without preconditions, the language of reconciliation, all while the actions of escalation take place. It's hard for me to wrap my head around where exactly this is and where it goes.
Well, I think he's trying to represent, as you say, his openness to talks. And there is a belief among the Washington policy establishment that Iran will be brought to its knees by these sanctions and come rushing back to the negotiating table. I think the likelihood of that happening anytime soon is very slim. And from the Iranian point of view, their calculus is, well, let's wait this out another year or so and see if Trump is still going to be in the White House for another 4 years, and then we can readjust our thinking. But ultimately, the bigger issue, I think, is that the deal was working. It was doing what it was designed to do. Iran wasn't going above and beyond the limitations under the deal, even though they weren't getting much relief from the lifting of sanctions because the U.S. placed new sanctions on them. And ultimately, I think what's come out of it is a real blow to American credibility around the world. Does our signature at the bottom of an agreement mean anything anymore? And as Republicans at the time said, no, it doesn't mean anything, that this is just an executive order that the next president can undo. But if that's the case, and that's a precedent that we're going to set, who's going to want to do deals with us in the long term?
Well, Jason, you wrote in The Washington Post recently, you say that the president, based on where we are now, may have the power to support the people of Iran while putting pressure on its theocratic government and its elites. How do you propose that the Trump administration use this window? The president says he wants to sit down. You say there are things he can really do to make it more likely to get Iran to step back.
I think every president of the United States, including this one, has a unique pulpit to really express the ideals that this country was founded on and that for most of our histories we've lived up to. Free expression, human rights, democracy, equality. He doesn't care about that. He doesn't care about promoting those values. But if he did, he would find an Iranian public that's receptive to that message. It's one of the few publics that hasn't been the beneficiaries of American largesse, either in terms of financial investments in the country, but also rhetorical investments. It's a country that we've demonized since 1979, and the demonization is not just of the state. It's the state and its people.
So how practically could the United States encourage the people of Iran that the United States, even if they do it quietly, stands for the values that that they stand for, if not necessarily the authoritarians and the theocrats in Tehran?
Well, the first step would be to do the reverse of what the Trump administration has actually done. This travel ban that has been placed on several countries, including Iran, is the first kind of symbolic reminder to the Iranian people that this is not an administration that is on their side. For decades, Iranians made up the largest number of students in American universities from abroad. That's kind of ground to a halt since the Trump administration started. It's nearly impossible for Iranian citizens to even visit the United States right now. So there is no exchange of people and ideas. Follow that up with, helping to open up expression, free expression in Iran, which obviously it's one of the countries that's the most tightly controlled in terms of people's ability to express themselves either through traditional media or on the internet. There's a lot of blockages of social media. People have a tough time getting their word out. But when they look at this president and his contempt for journalism and free expression, again, they don't see somebody that's on their side. So when I say that President Trump has the opportunity to do this, I'm not being facetious or sarcastic, but the truth is he hasn't shown any kind of desire to do that.
We'll continue our conversation about the United States and Iran in just a moment. I'm speaking with Jason Rezaian, global opinion writer at The Washington Post and author of Prisoner, My 544 Days in an Iranian Prison. We'll talk about some of those 544 days with Jason Rezaian. I'm Todd Zwillick. Glad to be with you. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Google. Veteran Mitch Hoyt founded Skinny Sticks Maple Syrup, and he's showing that small businesses can do big things. Mitch started making syrup from a few trees in his Wisconsin backyard and now is connecting with customers worldwide with help from Google Tools. Skinny Sticks is one of millions of small businesses using Google to grow. Learn how Google is helping businesses in your state at google.com/economic impact.
There's more to watch and read these days than any one person can get to. That's why we make Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Twice a week, we sort through the nonsense, share reactions, and give you the lowdown on what's worth your precious time. Listen and subscribe to NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour.
This is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick. We're talking about U.S.-Iran relations with Jason Rezaian of The Washington Post. Jason was serving as The Washington Post Tehran bureau chief when he was imprisoned in an Iranian prison for over a year and a half under charges of espionage. The weight of this entire discussion came down on your shoulders at one point when you wound up in an Iranian prison. I know that people have used the word pawn in your situation. It kind of minimizes the fact that maybe you're worth a little more than a pawn.
Yeah, I always tell people I don't play chess, but, you know, at least call me the horse.
At least the horse. Nevertheless, a token, a playing piece anyway, all of these huge global issues that we're talking about came right down on top of your head a couple of years ago. Why exactly did you go from being a Washington Post correspondent, reporter, opinion writer, for Tehran Bureau to a prisoner in a jail?
I mean, I think I always go back to that, the answer that they asked. They asked the man who climbed Everest why he did it. And he said it was because it was there, right? Because yeah. I was there. I was a U.S. citizen working for the paper of record of the United States of America at this moment of intense negotiations between the two countries, the first real contact diplomatically in over 30 years. And there were people that were strongly opposed to that deal, both here in Washington and in Tehran. And one of those factions in Iran thought that taking me might be a good way to disrupt the negotiations. And it turned out that they were right. Ultimately, though, I think that that both sides decided that there wasn't going to be any movement on my situation until the whole thing came together.
You said at one point, they never touched me, but I was tortured in their captivity. What were conditions like?
From the first night, my wife and I were taken from our home, blindfolded. We were separated and processed fairly quickly. Once they had taken my clothes and my possessions, they gave me a pair of, you know, prison pajamas and threw me into a solitary confinement cell, which was about 4.5 feet by 8.5 feet. I could lie down in one direction and not the other. The lights were on 24 hours a day, you know, kind of artificial neon lights. I had nothing in that cell besides toothbrush, no bed, no chair, no books, no human interaction. The only human interaction I had was with my interrogators, and they would take me out without any warning and throw me into another room blindfolded and question me for hours on end about things that made absolutely no sense. But I learned pretty quickly that the whole goal is to really disconnect you from reality, and that's what solitary confinement is designed to do. It's designed to make people go mad, and it works.
But why? Why you? I mean, if you were a big player or you were actually a spy or they caught you, had information that they could really use, you'd say, OK, that's inhumane, but there's a purpose.
Was
there a purpose?
I think initially there was no real purpose other than to muddy the situation. I was literally the only U.S. citizen working in Iran as a journalist at that point. Other U.S. news organizations, New York Times, AP, had had bureau chiefs, had correspondents, but none of them were American citizens. And I think that they gambled that this would be a high-profile way to really shine a negative light on the idea of opening up Iran, because you know you have to remember that there are politics inside Iran, and there are factions that I would argue there are two defining factions: the ones that want to have an open relationship with the rest of the world, and the ones who don't. And I was taken by the ones who don't.
One listener emailed with a question for you, Jason. What can Jason tell us about what Iran considers prisoner mistreatment compared to United States prisons?
Well, I can tell you that oftentimes when I would complain about my treatment, when I complained about solitary or the fact that the lights were on 24 hours a day or that I was denied access to communications with the outside world, denied access to newspapers, denied due process and legal representation. I was interrogated for 7 months without having a lawyer. Literally, never met a lawyer until I was put into the Revolutionary Court. Anytime I would complain about this, their response was, "Well, we're not as bad as Guantanamo," and that's a pretty low bar. But it's an important reminder that you know, if we in the United States are not going to uphold you know, due process and the rule of law, we shouldn't expect the worst regimes in the world to do so either.
Well, Jason, your book is, the short title is Prisoner, My 544 Days. You know, for some people, memoirs like this can be cathartic and therapeutic. For some people, they can be extraordinarily painful. I've met authors who wrote books maybe in a similar genre to yours who in the end regretted it because of what was dug up. I wonder what it was like for you to comb back through these memories to write your memoir of being held captive.
Well, I don't think it was cathartic in the traditional sense of the word or during the process. When I wrote most of the book, the experiences were still fairly raw. And when I sat down and wrote the hardest parts, my arrest, you know, solitary confinement, and frankly, the last 24 hours before my release, you know, the nightmares of being back in prison returned for weeks on end. But ultimately, I'm really happy that I have this document of my experience. And I think that now, rather than a wound that continues to be picked at or a scab that gets broken over and over again, this is now just a story of something that happened in my life that turns out was improbable and incredible.
Well, Jason, before we say goodbye to you, I want to bring in our next guest a little early because you and he have something in common that I think that probably both of you wish that you didn't at this point. Stories of imprisonment, I think for the two of you are very different, but you both have memories and stories of identity, human worth, and memoirs. Joining us now from NPR in New York is George Takei. George, who played Mr. Sulu, of course, on Star Trek. He's now an activist. He's an on-again, off-again announcer on the Howard Stern Show, of all places, and co-author of his new graphic memoir called They Called Us Enemy. George Takei, how wonderful to have you here. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be here with you.
George, I know that you've been listening to Jason's story, and you're probably familiar with it anyway. Common threads. You hear Jason talking not only about his imprisonment, but also about what it meant for him to drag it all back, to write a memoir to share with everyone else. And I wonder if any of that sounds familiar to you.
Well, listening to it, it is very sobering. But the only common aspect of our stories is that we were both in prison. He was an adult. I was a five-year-old kid when I was rounded up with my family and imprisoned. He was in prison in Iran, a foreign country. My family was American. I was born here in the United States. My mother was born in Sacramento, California. My father was born in Japan, but he was his mother died when he was very young, and his widower father brought my father and his older brother, when they were very young, to San Francisco, and he was raised as an American, educated and raised in San Francisco. The only thing he couldn't be was a naturalized American, because immigrants from Asia were the only ones denied naturalized citizenship. So my father was not an American citizen, although he, for all rights and purposes, was an American. He spoke English fluently. He knew American history. He knew the civics of this country. We were American citizens imprisoned in our own country, here in the United States, by the United States government in America, in our case, first in the swamps of Arkansas, and then transferred to another camp in Northern California. So it's quite different, our stories.
Yes.
But we were both imprisoned, and that's the common ground.
George, just 5 years old, as you mentioned, when you and your family were imprisoned at first by your own government during World
War II. The United States.
Yeah. How did your parents explain to you at the time what was happening, where you were going? Do you remember?
Yes, I do. I remember it so much more vividly now, I think. My father told us that we were going on a long vacation to a place called Arkansas. Arkansas sounded exotic to me. I'd never heard that name. It could have been Honolulu. I mean, it was equally foreign to me. And it was an exciting and and it was an adventure of discovery for me. I was an innocent child. I still remember the barbed wire fence today that confined us. I remember the sentry towers with the soldiers aiming their guns at us. I remember the searchlight that followed me when I made the night runs from our barrack to the latrine. But to five-year-old me, I thought it was nice that they lit the way for me to pee. Children are amazingly adaptable. And so I use that five-year-old boy's eyes to tell that story, begin telling this story, to get the reader in. And then I revealed to them the larger reality that my parents were going through. It was a grotesque experience. We were innocent, totally innocent of any crime other than looking like the people that bombed Pearl Harbor. But they were stripped of everything.
Jason, you talk in your book about dual identities as an Iranian and as an American, about how your imprisonment led you to rethink the idea of living in between these two countries. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Sure. I want to say hello to George.
Hi.
I'm a big fan for many years.
Well, thank you.
And, you know, I also want to say that my sister-in-law is Japanese origin, born and raised here in the United States. Her parents and her grandparents were all imprisoned in those camps as well. So this is a story that I've been familiar with for much of my adulthood. And unfortunately, as Iranians in this country, we've suffered a lot of backlash since the 1970s.
Yes.
And that continues to this day. And as I've watched the crisis at the border and the images that we've all seen over the last couple of weeks, I worry that we're descending into similar situations to what my father and contemporaries of his that came from Iran to this country dealt with in the 70s, and what George and my brother's in-laws dealt with in the 1940s.
Jason Rezaian, I want to thank you for joining us for the first half of this hour. Jason is a global opinions writer at The Washington Post, author of the new book, Prisoner, My 544 Days in an Iranian Prison. Jason, thank you so much for making the time.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
We're going to continue our conversation with activist, Star Trek star, and personality George Takei in just a moment. Stay close. This is 1A.
Support also comes from Rothy's. Rothy's are the everyday flats for life on the go. Stylish, versatile, fully machine washable, and they go with everything from yoga pants to dresses and skirts. Best of all, there's zero break-in period thanks to their woven design, seamlessly crafted from recycled water bottles. Plus, Rothy's always come with free shipping and free returns and exchanges. Find out why BuzzFeed called them their forever shoes at rothys.com/1A.
What if video games could help you and your child bond and learn important skills? NPR's Life Kit for Parenting is taking on screen time.
One of the big things we're working on right now is the concept of resiliency and not quitting when something is hard.
Sometimes we lose and lose and lose.
And games are great with that.
Check out Life Kit's new guide on screen time or subscribe to Life Kit All Guides for all of our episodes, all in one place.
This is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick, and I'm speaking with George Takei, actor, activist, co-author of a new graphic memoir called They Called Us Enemy. George Takei, you had a lot of choices in making a graphic memoir. You chose to make this essentially a children's book in children's sensibilities and appealing to children. Why did you choose that?
Well, this is a story that I've told in an autobiography that was published in 1994. But still, to this day, when I share my childhood story with a person that I consider well-read, well-informed, they are aghast that something like this happened here in the United States. Mm. There are so many, yet to this day, there are so many Americans that don't know this chapter of American history. And so I thought this would be a way to get young people, while they're still fresh and absorbing information, via a form that is attractive to them. I remember as a kid, I read comic books too. And so to tell it as this kind of story from a child's vantage point and then expand it to the reality of what happened. You were saying that, you know, this is a phenomenon in America, but it is not. Throughout American history, this kind of injustice and cruelty inflicted on minorities have been ongoing, repeated, recycled over and over again from what we know about the Native Americans and slavery, the history of slavery. And there is a parallel with Jason's story. When they were the Muslim Americans here were sweepingly characterized as potential traitors and terrorists, and Trump's first executive order was the Muslim travel ban, I recognized that immediately as the same kind of mentality that put us in these prison camps. So there are parallels to Jason's story, and this is a repetition of the same thing that's been happening throughout history. I wrote this book as a book of hope, that when we have young people informed of these chapters of American history, that they grow up knowing our fallibility and that it won't happen again.
George, so much of this is what people might consider decades-old history of World War II. You talked about the recent history of the travel bans by our own government today, and then this month, this week, we're learning, of course, of the internment, the separation of children along our own southern border here in the United States. And you are never one, especially on social media, to shy away from the hottest political debates. And you did it again last week because New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York came under fire on Fox News and other places as well. She used the term concentration camp to describe some of the detention centers along the border. And you tweeted, you came up in solidarity with that idea. Talk about that term, concentration camp, what it means to you, and why you would say that it's appropriate. So many people reacted angrily and viscerally to the idea that the United States could have a concentration camp, but you say, yes, it can.
Well, it's the Jewish people that feel that calling what we were in a concentration camp diminishes their experience. That is not true. The Jewish people were incarcerated, not just the Jewish people, but communists and Romas and homosexuals in Europe were incarcerated in death camps, extermination camps. The purpose of those camps was to exterminate these people. In our case, they were concentration camps. The dictionary definition of concentration camp is to gather people of a common heritage, race, or faith behind barbed wires for political purposes. It's the perfect definition of what we were imprisoned in.
George, I don't endorse the statements that any politician makes. I don't do that. But I something really struck me about the aftermath of this debate after Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez used that term. People like you who have a voice came out for her. Others came out against her. We wound up in this strange place in this country where we were debating, if I dare say, just how Nazi these detention camps are. You know, it doesn't have to be Auschwitz. It's not Auschwitz. We know it's not. But it's also not nothing. It's not Disneyland, surely. And we wound up in this hot national debate about just how similar to the horror of Nazi Germany it really is. And that, to me, just that dynamic, was a very disturbing place to see this country in.
I kept emphasizing that what the Nazis did was intentional. It was political to kill them, to murder them. They were death camps. They were extermination camps. And I think it's very important that we call it by its proper name. When we were concentrated behind barbed wire fence, the purpose was to keep us imprisoned, to punish us for being who we were. And they categorized us as enemy alien. So that by just that arbitrary categorization, they felt that it justified that. But to feel that this is equal to that is egregiously mistaken. We were not to be exterminated. Yes, people did die. Some people were shot by the guards, and there were riots where people were shot. Some people went crazy, and very enfeebled older people who were pulled out of hospitals and imprisoned died. And that was, you know, I mean, you could have predicted that they were going to die. But that was not the political purpose of our incarceration. It was to concentrate us behind barbed wires. We got to call what the Nazis did by its proper name. It was not a concentration camp for political purposes. It was a death camp. They were extermination camps. Gas chambers. We didn't have those. So we have to be, I mean, if we're going to have a great big discussion, which to me sounds diversionary of the real outrage that should be going on, is to know what we're talking about. And what we were incarcerated in were concentration camps. But what's going on the southern border has reached a new low. I was together with my parents. My brother, my sister, my baby sister, and infant were together with our parents. We were not separated. What is happening on the southern border is egregious.
Well, George Takei, we have just about a minute left. I just like to say I've always marveled at your career. You know, you were on Star Trek as a young man way back then. You could have easily spent a career as sort of a campy, goofy, cameo Star Trek personality. And you chose activism. You chose to be active. You chose to have a funny career, but a career with meaning behind it. And I don't care your politics. People can agree or disagree, but you've chosen to have a career of meaning. And it's a pleasure for me to have the opportunity to thank you for it, George Takei. What a wonderful career.
Well, you're thanking my father as well, because he's the one that told me when I was a teenager and grilling him about the internment experience, he told me that our democracy is a people's democracy. We've got to engage and actively participate in the process of keeping our democracy.
That's actor, activist, author of the new graphic memoir called They Call Us Enemy, George Takei. George, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This show was produced by Catherine Fink and edited by Miranda Fulmore. To learn more about them and the rest of the team, visit the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington. It's distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Todd Zwillick. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.